The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'd like to welcome you tonight to the Parkway Central Library. My name is Steve Altschuler, and I'm a member of the Free Library of Philadelphia Board of Trustees and the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Now, tonight, being from the medical field, I'm especially honored to introduce tonight's special guest, a Nobel Prize-winning cancer biologist. Dr. Howard Varmus truly knows the subject of his new memoirs, The Art and Politics of Science. As the former director of the National Institutes of Health, currently the president of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, and co-chair of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, Dr. Varmus is praised for translating his scientific work into public service. In his new memoirs, Dr. Varmus provides readers with behind-the-scenes look into the world of high-stakes, big-budget science, and exposes tensions between laboratory researchers, clinical investigators, scientists, and politicians. I think it'll actually be interesting tonight to hear his views on healthcare reform. The House just today introduced a very forward-thinking bill that, if passed, would completely change the way that we do medicine in this country. Now, scientific... Okay. Scientific American writes of his new works, "The book is like the man, honest and clear-eyed, thoughtful and outspoken, always good company, with more than a frequent touch of humor and self-deprivation." Interviewing Dr. Varmus this evening is Philadelphia's own Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Daily News and the creator of the new syndicated cartoon strip Family Tree, Signe Wilkinson. We are honored to have Dr. Varmus here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Harold Varmus and Signe Wilkinson.
Hello. Thanks
for coming. We solved the first problem. You're
yes.
On the left.
Right. Well, it is my pleasure to welcome Harold Varmus, who's an old friend of mine from California, to Philadelphia and to the Free Library. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Some of you might be thinking that to interview a man who's won the Nobel Prize in Medicine, it might have been smart of the library to have on stage two people who know what an oncogene is. But the problem is that in Philadelphia, there are so many medical superstars that to ask any one of them would have been intimidating for our speaker. So they invited a doctor of cartooning. So I will ask him a few softball questions, and I'll turn the mics to you in a few minutes, and you can ask him the really tough questions you've always wanted to know, like, what kind of bike did he ride to the NIH every day? That'll be up to you. To start, I want to say that this isn't the kind of book cartoonists would necessarily pick up, but it's a terrific book, and you're all going to buy 5 copies, and they're all upstairs. So that's your orders for your evening. But what I found kind of interesting as a former English major was that one of your central premises is that scientists aren't simply born. You use your own life story to sort of say that even adult brain cells that have been exposed to vast amounts of English literature can be reprogrammed. and made to absorb and even commit acts of science. So what I was wondering, in your book, he describes many incidents between Amherst College and his life in science. But was there any one that was like an aha moment, or was it just this accumulation of many smaller things that led you in that path?
Well, when you say path, you're referring to the path away from literature into science?
Yes.
First of all, I began life, if I were programmed in any way, to become a physician. My father was a general practitioner. I grew up in a comfortable middle-class Jewish community in the South Shore of Long Island, and the expectations.
There's another Nobel Prize
Merrick,
winner right
Merrick,
there.
Baldwin, Levitan. Most times did. There were a certain amount of expectation. I wasn't particularly interested in science as a high school student. I didn't go to science fairs. I wasn't inspired by my chemistry teacher. In fact, if anything, depressed by my chemistry teacher. But somewhere along at college, where I went as a pre-medical student, I began to get a sense of excitement, not from science, which was also well taught there, but from the notion of reading as a kind of experimental experience a very important moment in my development as a scientist, I would argue, is reading some of the work of some of the early new critics like I.A. Richards, who said, the evidence is on the page, forget about biography and about history, probably an overstatement, but look at the words on the page and try to figure out what this means, what the author is trying to tell you. And that was my first introduction to the notion that all of us are exposed to evidence and that we are being then asked to decide what it is about the data that we can learn something from. And when I began to make the connection between looking at the words of a novel or the words in a poem or a letter and learning something about the imagination and the emotional life of the author, I was laying a foundation for something that I found very exciting later on when I ended up in a laboratory, not so much because I wanted to be a scientist, but because I had gone to medical school. I was subject to the draft. This is the Vietnam years. My choices were pretty simple, Canada or the Public Health Service. And I was fortunate, despite a lack of research experience, to get a position in a laboratory at the NIH. And frankly, if you look back at those few days when I and many hundreds of other anti-war physicians went to the NIH to compete for these few slots, the one saving moment for me was when I interviewed with a young scientist, a physician scientist named Ira Paston, whose wife happened to be a poet, now the poet laureate of Maryland, Linda Paston. And she frequently complained to Ira, the people who work with you never seem to know anything about books. So he saw me as somebody who had some experience in literature and said, I'll take this guy and make my wife happy. So that was a good thing. And so I think, one of the themes of my book is not just, at least the autobiographical part as opposed to the science itself, is that not only are the thought processes that one engages in as a literature student or an historian or a scientist fairly similar in many ways, and brains quite similar, but that the way you end up where you are is often the result of completely unpredictable things. I certainly feel that I was buffeted about by these experiences of needing to do certain things, ending up interacting with the right person, being in the right place, encountering the right opportunity to do something interesting.
One of the really distressing parts of the book, I thought, was that you were the editor of the Amherst College newspaper. Mm-hmm. I mean, could you imagine?
Not the cartoonist, though.
Not the cartoonist. But just think, if he'd gone into journalism, he'd be trying to figure out where Michael Jackson is buried right now. think what a loss that would have been to research. But you actually say in the book that in various places that English, your English studies came in handy. For example, when you had to pick out a poem to read at a poetry festival, you could actually pick it out. Does it help in other ways?
I think it helps. One of the things that people discover when they have taken a more traditional march toward a scientific career, that is, they did love their high school chemistry teacher, and they did know from the start they wanted to be a scientist, mm-hmm. And they loved being an experimentalist as a student and as a postdoc. At some point, there's a recognition that as a member of a faculty and as a senior scientist, you spend a lot of time reading, writing, and speaking. And it is helpful to know the rules of grammar, to have some sense of style, mm-hmm. Have some skills in communicating to diverse audiences. And then, but I would argue that that's a fairly utilitarian way to view a background in literature. And, what I still find useful about that training is that I still like to read. Mm-hmm. and I look forward to a novel. Today is an important day in my life, as you heard, because I have my Kindle, which is, I'm not sure that's a popular thing to say in a library, but we have to face up to the fact that, and I hope we get back to this, that in all forms of reading and writing, the medium is changing, and hope we'll talk about that in relation to scientific reporting, too.
Well, why don't we just dive right in? Projects that you've undertaken now is to work on the public access of all scientific documents, as I understand it. And so can you just tell us a little bit how that would work, and is this good for the library or bad for the library?
Oh, it's very good for the library. I mean, there's a fundamental difference between libraries and the whole publishing industry as it relates to authors like the author of my book, who write with the expectation of making some money. Certainly my brother-in-law, who's a novelist, or you and my wife as journalists, do this for a living. Scientists don't do that. When we write only for one thing, for fame. In other words, we want people to read about our experiments and to build on them. So we don't get a penny for the scientific literature we produce in scientific journals, or writing a review article for a compendium of articles that are meant to be used in teaching. We might make money from a textbook or a biography, but in general, the basic precept is we want the information out there. Well, 400 years ago, when scientific journals began at the Royal Society in England, because that's one of the places it began, there weren't very many ways to do that, and we were very dependent on people who did have a press and knew how to publish things, and on the existence of review processes. And for a few hundred years, we were all happily dependent on journals that raised the real costs of publishing by selling subscriptions. That was fine. But as of the last 20 years, the Internet has changed everything. So now you can make one copy of a scientific paper, and you can put it on the web, and anybody can see it, and there are no further costs. You don't need to put it onto boats and trains and put it in the mail. There are some reviewing costs and editing costs, but they're fairly modest. And all of us who do research, especially research of the type that I do, biomedical research, know that it costs a lot. The average scientific paper costs about $1,000 to publish, but the work that's described in that paper costs about $200,000 to do. Moreover, that money does not come from my pocket. That money comes from the NIH. It comes from your pockets. And we, all of us who are in this scientific world, believe that we have some responsibility to the public that supports our work. And part of that responsibility is to be sure the information we generate as a result of the taxpayer dollars that we use in our research is, A, used by other scientists to make new discoveries that will improve public health and deepen our understanding of the natural world. But in addition, we think that there are people in the general public who really want to see what we are discovering, teachers and journalists and students and people who are advocates for progress against disease. And I find it really despicable that somebody who has been paying taxes regularly for 30 years and wants to find out the latest findings on Alzheimer's disease would go to the internet and be unable to get the results of research that's public, that's executed, carried out with public money. So about 10 years ago, as I describe in what my wife would consider boring detail in this book, we began to think about ways in which the NIH could play a definitive role in trying to make information much more accessible. And being in a free library is a nice place to talk about this. The jump to the chase is a result of a lot of advocacy, a lot of hard work, and especially an act of Congress. It's now required that all work that is supported by the NIH be in the public domain in a library that we built at NIH called PubMed Central within a year after publication. But it is possible to take the whole process a step further. And about 8 years ago, some colleagues of mine and I established a publishing house called the Public Library of Science, where we have changed the manner of publishing. So instead of having your article accepted by a journal and then have the journal raise the money to pay for the reviewing and publishing costs by selling subscriptions, instead we take articles at the Public Library of Science from scientists who, once their paper is accepted, will use some of their grant money, 1% of the money they might have used for the study, and pay for the publication costs, which usually range from $1,000 to $3,000. And in that way, everything that we publish, and you can all see this at www.plos.org, everything in all of our journals is made instantaneously available to anyone in the world who's got the hardware and software to go on the internet. And that all that information also goes into the public library, PubMed Central. And the world is changing. There's no doubt that this is becoming much more accepted. There are many hundreds of open access, as they're called, scientific journals. There are more libraries around the world, not just PubMed Central in the U.S., also one in the U.K., and there'll be one in Asia pretty soon. And other fields are either, some cases, ahead of us. Physics has been somewhat ahead. Other fields are catching up. But eventually, science will become universally accessible.
The only thing I would disagree in that whole description was about journalists getting paid.
It's a good idea, though.
It's a great idea, but thanks to free everything on the internet, that model is changing.
Well, we didn't decide that.
No.
Talk to your publisher.
You.
I don't think it's a great idea either.
Well, back to maybe some of the things that people really know you for is the big public job you had was at the NIH, which seems, I mean, I would think that just researching cancer in a lab would be really easy compared to having to run NIH and having to deal with Congress, presidents, tons of scientists, budgets. I mean, you describe all these committees you had to be on.
I didn't have to be on them. You establish them and let someone else do the work.
Yeah.
Deputizing is an important skill.
My question reading it was, like, how much sleep do you get a night?
Well, NIH is an interesting place to run. Does everybody know NIH
is? I'm serious. Wait a minute. How much sleep do you get a night?
Oh, 7 hours.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, fine.
But, you know, people think NIH must be a very hard place to run because it has a very big budget. It's now $30 billion plus $10 billion mm-hmm. in stimulus money. There are 27 institutes and centers. There are 20,000 employees, the NIH. There are about 40,000 grants that go to every district in the country. So a lot going on. On the other hand, one of the reasons I became dissatisfied with the job of running the NIH is that there wasn't enough to do. And what I mean by that is that the NIH director himself, or herself, doesn't actually have authority, at least didn't in my time. There's been some improvement since then, don't have very much authority over very much money yourself. You don't start grant programs. The 27 institutes and centers each have directors. They have they're authorized to carry out their own research programs. They get a direct appropriation. And those are the folks who actually fund and do the science. So the NIH director sitting up there overseeing all this, obviously there are interesting things that happen, but you don't feel like you're managing programs in quite the way that your vision of it would forbid me to have any sleep. On the other hand, while you're over all these people and grants and sort of in a supervisory position, you're also at the beck and call of literally every member of Congress, mm-hmm. virtually anybody who's Senate confirmed in the government, many advocacy groups, and that's what makes the job particularly hard. There are a lot of folks who want a piece of you from, every 5 minutes.
Well, you described a couple of times when people put pressure on you to get you to change, to do things. I was wondering, how did you put pressure on congressmen? I mean, you had to prepare a budget. You had to appear in front of Congress to get your budget passed. How did you make
There really
sure
wasn't much pressure I could put on members of Congress, I'm sorry to say. I would have liked to at several points. But on the one hand, with Congress, my goal was to try to explain what we did. Mm-hmm. And when we did something wrong, try to apologize and say how we would straighten it out. Because there were times, as I describe in the book, when we were caught, you know, with our pants down, frankly, and having done something that was inappropriate. But there were times when I had to try to influence the directors of these 27 institutes and centers to do the right thing. And that wasn't always so easy because they really had their own appropriated funds, tried to build a sense of cooperation and collegiality at the NIH, and I think that actually worked out pretty well. We did a lot of things together. But it is hard when every institute is under the same kind of pressures I'm under. That is, their advocacy groups want them to do certain things. To get them to put voluntarily money that they've been appropriated into a common pool to do something together puts them at some risk.
Well, one of them that you described was one thing that pressured you was since it's in your book, I can name names, a certain vice president named Al Gore coming and pretty much ordering you to double the cancer budget. I thought how you dealt with it was sort of indicative of how you dealt with other things.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. The president.
He's taller than you.
No, he's not. He's heavier.
Okay.
But the president had agreed that we were going to, you know, the national economy was in much better shape than it's in today, and that we were going to do something serious about increasing the NIH budget. And the proposal the president was willing to make was to increase the NIH budget by $1 billion in 1 year. And at that point, that was a roughly 8-something percent increase, would have been the largest increase in history as a dollar value. And Al Gore made the case that we ought to be increasing overall budget by something that approached 50%, but that the cancer budget should double. And I don't fully understand all the reasons why he made that case. Part of it had to do with his sister having died of lung cancer. He was very concerned about cancer. Part of it is he was responsive to a national concern about cancer, which is perfectly appropriate. I feel that as well. After all, I've done cancer research all my life, and I have had friends and relatives die of this disease, and it's not pretty. And part of it, I think, had to do with some commitments he had made to cancer advocacy groups who were going to support his candidacy for president. But the argument we took to him was that while cancer is in the forefront, in some ways, that is in the forefront of people's minds. And frankly, if you've been following what President Obama says about the NIH, he does feature cancer in his own discussions of what the NIH does. But there are a lot of other diseases, and sometimes you can't really predict where the important discoveries are going to come. And a lot of what we do is basic research, and sometimes that's the most important thing to do because, you know, if somebody had not been, for example, working on how these strange viruses, retroviruses, actually grow, 15 years later we would not have been as swift to recognize the cause of AIDS and develop drugs that actually control HIV infection. So there's a big there are many reasons to believe that investment in basic biology is a very important role for the NIH, and that doesn't always count in these kinds of computations. Moreover, it put me in a very difficult position to say that the Cancer Institute, as opposed to the other 26 institutes, was going to get a much more rapid rate of increase, when, in fact, when you look across the institutes, sometimes the needs are greater in other places. For example, at that very time, as the vice president agreed, and to his credit, he sat down with Donna Shalala and me at a time when he could have blown us off, and he said, let me hear what your arguments are, and he changed his mind. And we explained that the Genome Institute, a lot of what it does is cancer research, but for cancer research to advance, we really have to sequence the human genome and begin to understand the parts that go into making up a human being and that go awry when cancer arises.
So your power of persuasion worked.
In that case, it helped to have Donna Shalala by my side, I have
to
say. Having the spark plug with you was good.
Well, I'm sure this will be something that others will want to ask about, but you did write in a book that although you're not a religious man in the traditional sense, that you said some of man's deepest questions about the origins of the universe or the purpose of life remain beyond the grasp of science and are currently addressed only by the beliefs that belong to religion. When I look at that, I can't help but think of all the religious controversies that have used science as the lever, stem cell, abortion, creationism. And we just had the new NIH director is a... It says he's a born-again Christian. I was wondering if you could describe a little bit about that intersection of faith and science and how you think it's affected your work and maybe the work going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally not a person of faith, but I do recognize that there are some questions that go very deep that I don't know how to answer. And as the next sentence in that final.
I couldn't read the whole thing.
I know you shouldn't read the whole thing, but the point I try to the really thing I'm leading up to in that kind of a post an epilogue is to say yes, I can't get my mind around those problems. They're not problems we can solve by scientific methods at this point, and perhaps never. But the only way I find to live with an incomprehensible universe is to do something that I find profoundly satisfying, which is to do experiments, to work in the realm where I can get evidence and can begin to develop answers and do some good for my fellow human beings who are similarly perplexed about these fundamental facts of the strange existence we have.
And so you come from it from that point of view. How do you think, you've mentioned Francis Collins a
sure.
few times in the book, you've worked with him. How do you think that will affect his...
Well, Francis and I have definitely a different perspective on how humanity acquired certain traits, altruism, for example. I'm willing to think with Ed Wilson and others about ways in which a trait like generosity might have had an evolutionary advantage. Francis wants to think that it's a manifestation of something spiritual, which I can't connect with. I was just at something called the Darwin Festival at the University of Cambridge last week. Celebration at his own college, at Darwin's College, of the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. And these issues about the spheres of religion and science very much manifest. Dan Dennett got up and said, there's nothing left for God to do anymore. He's just playing the air guitar. And And there were many people of that persuasion, you know, fully insulting to anybody who might have a shred of religiosity. And during that week, Francis Collins' nomination was announced, and I went out on this very smoothly manicured lawn of King's College, where a cocktail party before the dinner was being held, and a bunch of irate people came running up to me and said, "I can't believe it. Barack Obama has named a fundamentalist a Christian to run the NIH. How can this possibly be?" Well, you know, Francis is a great scientist. He's a magnificent leader and manager. He's very effective in dealing with Congress. He's a supporter of stem cell research. He's a strong proponent of using genetic information to inform medical decisions. There are many terrific things he's going to do, and I think he'll be an inspirational leader for the NIH. What some of us have been concerned about is that is the possibility that he would I actually don't think this would ever happen, but he has become so fervent about the religious component of his life that he started a foundation. I don't think he should be partaking in that activity while he's trying to run the NIH. It's the church and state. I just don't think there should be even any discussion of whether his religious views are going to affect decisions he makes about science policy. And for as far as I'm concerned, he's a great choice to be director, and I hope to be helping him and wishing him well.
Well, it's about time for you guys to start asking the really good questions. And the one I didn't get to that one of you has to ask, because I've been waiting for weeks to do any cartoons on healthcare until I find out what I think about healthcare. And so you're going to have to...
I'll know what I think when I see your cartoon.
This is a man with such attention to detail that he once sent me a note about a cartoon that appeared here first and then was reprinted in the LA Times with a correction on my thinking, which I certainly read and took into consideration. So, any rate, I will throw it open. Somebody has to ask about healthcare, but I don't care who it is.
No one has to ask about healthcare.
we'll have an aspiring scientist in the first row. Here's a mic.
Is the microphone?
Yes, stand up.
Hi. So I am a medical physics graduate student, and I read an article yesterday entitled "Why America is Flunking Science." And yes, was it on Slate or Salon? Salon. Thank you. And it was basically, and you can add to this, pointing to a gap in between the dialogue of scientists and the rest of the world or the rest of American culture, saying that there's really not much accurate back and forth discussion, that Americans don't necessarily have the access nor the drive to understand what's really being done in the scientific world. So I don't know if you agree with that assessment, if you think that some of that is there, and if you do, what can be done to better facilitate the discussion between scientists doing real science and Americans who are just living their lives.
Between scientists and English majors.
Well, I think the argument that America is either falling behind in science or not allowing a rich enough dialogue between scientists and non-scientists has many components. The one that I think has to be focused on most intensely is the way in which we teach science in elementary and high schools. One of my current jobs is as one of the co-chairs of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and one of the things we're concerned about is how to take the large number of studies that have recently pointed out some of the deficiencies in our public educational system. Most science teachers, for example, really never studied very much science. They're underpaid. We don't have equipment in the classroom for people to do experiments. We don't teach science in the right way. We depend much too heavily on rules of physical or natural systems written down in textbooks as opposed to the experimental method, which is the way students actually get excited about science. There are many failures. There are many trial balloons going on around the country, some of which are very successful. Many reports, one issued recently by the Carnegie Corporation, that list hundreds of ways to try to improve the system. And one of the things we're trying to do is to bring together a list of standards and practices that could be used as a model nationwide. Second issue has to do with how the conversation goes on. And I would argue that we've improved in the last 20 or 30 years, that there is more discussion, that the stem cell debate illustrated that quite well, that the public really learned a lot about stem cells to the point where stem cells were a more decisive issue in elections than the personality of candidates in some cases. I'm not sure everybody fully understood exactly what stem cells are, but they understood some of the principles and what the medical and scientific potential of stem cells might be. I think that was a very healthy exercise. I think many of my scientist colleagues could be faulted for not getting out and trying to explain what they do more fully in the public, but an awful lot of my friends do sort of what I'm doing tonight or other things. Actually, you mentioned Francis Collins. One of the times I first got a different kind of religion about scientists talking to the public, was when Francis appeared at a symposium on the genetic revolution sponsored by Stanford University. And I watched Francis and actually quite a few others, including myself, talk to this audience about what genes were and how they would play bigger roles in agriculture, manufacturing, computer life, medicine over the coming years, and heard an incredibly excited, informed discussion by people who weren't scientifically trained, who just were extremely interested in this. And then a couple of years later, we staged a similar thing in San Francisco, trying to explain the recombinant DNA revolution, where it came from, what it was doing to various aspects of life, ranging from use of DNA in forensics to settle legal cases to ways in which we could reconstruct evolutionary history by extracting DNA from bones of extinct animals. All this stuff is really pretty accessible, and you don't have to be able to go in the laboratory and do the experiment yourself. The third component, back to journalism, is the use of science in the world of journalism. And I think some papers, especially the New York Times, but some others as well, have been quite successful in developing science pages. The difficulty has been that it's hard to generate advertising for those pages. In general, science pages have been shrinking. There's also the difficulty of getting the science not just right, but described in a way that is interesting but doesn't overpromise. And it's very easy for any of us who are in the medical area in particular to say that my discovery could lead to a new treatment for cancer, when in fact, we've identified a new gene that might play some role in one kind of cancer, but therapy might be very far off. And yet, if you or your university or the journal that published the paper is interested in publicity, and I can tell you that those entities are interested in publicity, it's very easy to distort the story, and ultimately that undermines confidence. I mean, how many of you want to read another story about somebody isolating a gene? Well, it doesn't happen anymore anyway, because the whole genome has been sequenced, but unless you have, it's hard to get the message to the appropriate level, make it interesting and yet not distorted.
Another question back there? On the
right. You mentioned Al Gore doubling your budget. At what point is there a diminishing return versus an amount of money? In other words, if you could get an unlimited amount of money, or as much as you want it, let's put it that way, what are the limiting factors in available personnel, ability to orchestrate studies, ability to manage those studies, ability to wait until those studies prove useful or not.
Yeah,
in other words, isn't there a point beyond which money doesn't really matter?
Sure.
And how far from that is the NIH?
Yeah, let me try to answer. That's a very, very thoughtful question. Let me just say at the outset, Al Gore by himself can't double anybody's budget because that is to be done by Congress, but it made the proposal, and that's what we were discussing. You're quite right that you can't solve these problems with money alone, a point I often tried to make, that what really solves problems is talent. On the other hand, you can't do science without money. And how do you adjust the amount so it's in the right ballpark? And that's not very easy. I would argue that the NIH is still underfunded in the sense that there are more people out there with good ideas, inadequate equipment, underpaid postdocs and students. We don't do, you know, what are rules of thumb for how much we should invest in research and development? Most companies would say they should invest somewhere in the range of maybe 3 to 5% of their earnings into R&D. The healthcare industry is nearly a $2 trillion industry. We don't invest even close to 1% of that amount into research and development. If you add up what's been done in both the private and the public sector, it gets a little closer, but a lot of what the companies view as research is marketing research and stuff that you and I would not consider to be research that's really advancing the field. The costs of management are significant, but they are a very small fraction of the total cost. You can manage research extremely well with 3 or 4% of the total, so that's not a big part of it. But I would argue that if you look at facilities around the country, you'll find that many of them are in woeful state and that we should be, in fact, the stimulus package that was passed several months ago includes $1 billion, a fairly small amount, but a significant amount to try to upgrade facilities. But ultimately, you know, there's no clear, simple way to calculate when the scientific returns are no longer going to be valuable. In this country, we've taken the position, rightly or wrongly, but we have been very successful, that there's talent everywhere, and that even if you make an investment in grants at a university that doesn't produce terrific research, you do research, somebody as an undergraduate in that school may get excited about research, go on to a place where more exciting things are happening, and we invest a lot in training people. Now, the training patterns have changed. This comes back to the question about earlier question about where which countries are emphasizing science. Is there the question wasn't posed in exactly this way, but one of the things that all of us are concerned about is that the number of U.S. graduates, PhDs in sciences, especially physics and engineering and mathematics, but also in biology, is declining relative to graduates, China and India, other parts of Southeast Asia. And I strongly believe that our country's future is very closely tied to strong training of our young people in science, engineering, mathematics, and we're losing that. One way to guarantee that we have people interested in science is to make sufficient investment in biomedical research so that we're not just funding the very best, but that we're also funding very good scientists across the country who train a young person in Kansas who goes to Kansas State, as well as people who are able to do their undergraduate work at Harvard, where, of course, there's plenty of money for pursuing exciting research. More and more hands going up.
Yeah, good.
It must not like the answers.
Try to keep your... try to keep your question...
Yeah, I have a question that might be related to your ideas about publishing.
Sure.
Do you see any problem, or have you had any experience, or do you see problems in the peer review process that is inhibiting good information getting out? inhibiting the science development?
Peer review, of course, is an imperfect process, but it's the best we've got. I've been an advocate for some time of the idea that we as scientists ought to figure out ways to get information out the door, even if it doesn't pass strict peer review. And there are a lot of ways to do that. I mean, you can label something as not having been peer reviewed. You'll hear a number of my colleagues say, I don't want to look at anything that's not peer reviewed by the best journal in the business. That's pure hypocrisy, because these same folks go to scientific meetings where things are not peer-reviewed. Their colleagues get up at the podium and talk about their recent work without peer review, and you like it or don't like it, and you may be influenced by the person's reputation. At Public Library of Science, and you're allowing me to make a little plug here, we're about to do some experiments. For example, one important element of peer reviewing, one that has completely taken over scientific publishing, is the idea of not just how good the work is, but how important it is. And the journals that have become particularly rich and famous, like Science and Nature and Cell and a few others, have done so because based on a formula which is called the impact factor. People who actually are in Philadelphia at the Institute for Scientific Information have developed this we call bibliometric system that allows every journal to be accorded a number that reflects the number of times the average article in that journal is cited by somebody else. The number is flawed for reasons I'm not going to spend time describing, but the result is that a lot of what is called peer reviewing is not peer reviewing that is addressed at the experimental accuracy or the strategy of the experiments, but whether or not the result is interesting enough to appear in that journal and then be cited. So we started a very big journal we call PLOS One, in which we do the peer reviewing only for scientific credibility. We don't care if the result is highly interesting or not so interesting. If it's good science, fine, we publish it. We're starting something else very soon, and this is a pre-announcement, not official, something called PLOS Currents, in which we're going to have, in certain fields, journals, not really journals, they're notice boards, that will be curated by people to be who ascertain that we're not putting pornography or other, something outrageous up on the website. But if you've got an experiment, not a complete paper, that you want to present to people, you can do it, everybody knows what they're reading. They're reading work in progress, but in fields, for example, that address emerging infections or some sort of medical field that requires information to get out to the door more quickly, possible to do that.
How about over here? Okay, in the middle?
Somebody waving wildly in the back row. Yeah. That's very appealing.
Oh, I'll get to the back row next. Just go. Oh. Okay, him, and then here, and we'll go in the back.
Thank you. Dr. Varmus, when you mentioned the turning point in your career occurred during the Vietnam War, I thought of a book the title of which sounds very much like yours, that was published in 1967, I think. Dan Greenberg published The Politics of Pure Science. And the next year, people didn't know that science had politics at the time. I suppose that they thought that's why it was deserving of support. The next year, James Watson writes The Double Helix, and we see that there's an art to science, that he liked the aesthetic of the double helix form, experiment be damned. And I was just wondering if those were influential books to you, or what has been influential in terms of your understanding of the culture of science throughout your career? Thank you.
Well, Dan Greenberg's book is not a book I know, but I know Dan Greenberg very well, and I agree that Dan has been quite influential in my own thinking from the day I got to NIH and trying to explain to me how he thinks scientists and the government interact, and it's been quite helpful. Watson's book I still find really marvelous because it's not just the double helix is beautiful. what is really wonderful about the double helix, and that comes out very clearly in Jim's book, is that, first of all, the thought process, the way in which he gathered up information from various disparate sources to put the base pairing together, very important, but also the solution is not just aesthetically beautiful. It's not just the helix itself and the spiraling staircase that everybody knows about, but it's the pairing of the bases, and which allows an explanation for how DNA can replicate. He makes this very clear in one beautiful sentence in the Nature paper in 1953, and that kind of economical, aesthetic execution of science is very important. A man whose name unfortunately is escaping me at the moment has written about the discovery of the double helix in a way that reflects on the fact that some people often worry about that when you do science, you end up often discovering something that somebody else would have discovered. In other words, we would have figured out eventually that there was a double helix and that base pairing was important, so for how DNA replicated. But the way in which it's done is extraordinary, and the paper that Watson and Crick wrote is a model of economical thinking, and really quite inspirational. So there's no doubt that when I have an important finding, I'd like to think the paper I'm writing about it is a paper that my readers think is well written, and that the experimental strategy was clever, and we may get to the same point as somebody else, but there is a manner of doing science that can give you goosebumps.
Right here.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library. I'd be interested in your comments about science and energy, in particular Craig Venter's work. In terms of coming up with solutions, and more importantly, your role in terms of setting priorities. In other words, there's, I think, a minority opinion that says we spend too much money researching on medicine and not enough on researching scientific solutions to other pressing problems such as energy.
Yeah. Well, I would agree that we have under-supported energy research in this country for a long time, and certainly President Obama has felt that way. He campaigned on a promise to spend $15 billion a year on energy research, would be a very steep increase, and I certainly support that general idea if hopefully we can find the money. I happened to be talking at dinner about the article we all read in today's Times about Craig Venter's efforts to both generate new sources of energy and also to sequester carbon by growing algae and other microorganisms. Craig is a very inventive scientist, and one of the things that he's been doing recently, published, I must say, in Public Library of Science journals, all accessible to any of you. Go home tonight, go to plos.org and punch in Venter, and you'll see these wonderful articles in which Craig goes out in his sailing ships. He's a famous sailor, and gathers up microorganisms from the deep, things that we didn't know existed, genes we didn't know were out there, have been discovered by just probing the dark depths of the ocean, and there are more things already in the biological world than we have dreamt of, and some of these organisms have the potential to make petroleum-like molecules. Sequester oxygen and could be a tremendous boon to our need to reduce emissions and to generate new forms of energy. I don't, we were discussing at dinner tonight at Sydney's the question of, what the do-gooder intentions of those of us who, try not to print out too many pages of email or take other really modest measures to conserve energy and reduce emissions actually amounts to, and a radical revision of how we generate the energy that we're not about to give up. We're not prepared to turn the lights out in this room, I know that, but there must be other ways, and there are other ways to generate energy, and we need to exercise more of our ingenuity in finding it. I think all of us agree that in our council and president's office, that energy is going to be very high on the list. I don't think we necessarily overspend on medical research, but I do think that the underspending on some of the physical sciences has been pretty profound in the last couple of decades.
Okay, way in the back, somebody in the very back row.
You need a your long arm.
Yeah.
Okay, as has been said earlier tonight, with the deficit in terms of education for the United States versus other nations in tandem with PLOS, I'm wondering if it's too tangential for the goals of PLOS to be able to provide materials, educational materials for students, for curious individuals. Because, for example, I haven't been to college for every single science that I'm interested in, and I don't have degrees in every single thing I'm interested in, and I'm wanting to know if it's too tangential to PLOS to be able to provide fundamental materials such that I could understand the materials that those who do have degrees are publishing about.
Yeah, so you're raising a question about what Public Library of Science could do to promulgate educational tools and make them more available. And we probably can't do that on our own, but we are interested in helping others to do that. The NIH has actually done some things along these lines. They've put together workbooks on educational classroom exercises in a variety of biomedical fields, and those are available online because they're sponsored by the government, and the government is willing to put them online. So I'm not entirely sure where the question goes. Just that, at Public Library of Science per se, we are publishing scientific work. We're not an educational dissemination outlet. But one of the things we're trying to do is to encourage others to work with us to change the way scientists interact with each other and the way the scientists interact with the public. One way to do that is to generate what we call hubs or portals where we aggregate all the information that's available, whether it's published or in conventional journals or whether it comes from advocacy groups or from teachers, and try to build scientific communities so that, and you might imagine such a community being created around people who teach high school science courses. I think that kind of thing can be done. Our limitation as an organization to engage in all these forms of scholarly activity is that everything we do costs money, and we're just trying to make ends meet with a publishing method that has a business plan that is novel and is only now this year being shown that it actually works.
We have time for two more questions here.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question. Science inherently, I think, is a creative process that comes from inside. And because it is a creative process, it takes creative individuals sometimes who may or may not meet the norm in whatever way someone may perceive that. And I wonder if you share this view that in our organizations at the government level, at the business level, that sometimes we've actually systematically discouraged creativity in some regards, in the sense that I think, how do I phrase the question? In the problem with science, just as you said, that there needs to be a separation of religion and science, or religion and government, would you agree that maybe there needs to be somewhat of a separation between government and science?
And unfortunately, there really is. At this point, it's very difficult to separate government and science because government has become the major funder of science. Now there are other ways to fund it. I think you're getting at your question is getting another issue, which is very much on the minds of those of us who are trying to sustain the strength of American science at a time when the economy is faltering, interest in science in some quarters is failing. There's tremendous competition for grant money, And under those circumstances, there's a natural tendency of people who are reviewing applications and handing out money to tend to favor the sure thing that will produce some result as opposed to taking big risks. And we have not really figured out yet how to encourage sensible risk-taking because, frankly, a lot of ideas that look risky are also sort of wacky. And you don't want to spend all your money on the wacky stuff. How do you build balanced portfolios? Can you develop some rules for how you assign money to risky projects? Can you encourage other forms of funding, sometimes non-governmental funding? And that has happened. I've had friends who have a certain disease, who raise money for it, and then go to scientists and say, I'd like to get some of the best people who are doing work in other fields to work in this field. That's a good way to get people ginned up about working in some new area and doing something truly creative. And then there's the problem that was alluded to by the question out here that not everybody's really creative. I mean, there are many good scientists who will do good work, confirm other people's findings, do the technical part, and not everyone does something incredibly creative. So this is science like anything else. It's a very mixed population of people doing something that's inherently very interesting, and getting the money in the right pockets and the right people working on the right problems. These are difficult, I hate to call them managerial problems, but they're problems of social organization and networking that we don't know how to solve yet.
Okay, we have one last question, and I'll let Bettina Herlin, our former health commissioner of the city of Philadelphia.
So my question, because your lead-in tonight was a question about health care reform. Mm. So, of course, I can't resist going back to that. And I'd like to ask you your prediction in terms of whether there's going to be real health care reform as opposed to more Band-Aids and more incrementalism, particularly single-payer seems to be off the screen. And in that process, whether issues like the underfunding of public health, because we focus so much on health insurance, which is really important with access, but the fundamental issues of public health being really underfunded are going to get lost in the fray. It's a double question, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's actually a multi-layered question, and I'm not even sure whether you're asking me what's going to happen or what I'd like to see happen.
Oh, what would you like to see happen?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I would like to see America evolve to a single-payer system. But it's not going to happen this year. I think there are two things we can hope for this year. One, that there is a public option to insurance that is basically built on a Medicare kind of program. And I say that with a certain amount of concern because in my current job, which we really haven't talked about, I run a famous cancer hospital, Memorial Sloan Kettering, in which we serve about 40% of the patients we serve have Medicare. Every 1% of our patient volume that's Medicare costs us about $4 million a year. So we lose almost $200 million a year taking care of our Medicare patients. That's not a sustainable system. If we became entirely a hospital that dealt with a public people who are insured by public programs that don't pay a better rate for the kinds of services we offer, either we have to change the way we do business, which is, in my view, a very high quality operation taking care of very sick people, or we have to begin to ration medicine in a way that I don't like. I don't want to become a hospital that just takes care of people who have much more highly reimbursable programs. The second thing that I think will happen, so I said on the one hand, I think there will be a public option, not just a rich collection of an insistence that everybody get insured, but there will be, I think, a public option for insurance. The other thing I think will happen is that there will be much more attention in that public option to what
can be and should be delivered, that I think we'll have some real rules for how healthcare is delivered. I've been looking at systems in other countries. I think many people in the audience, certainly everybody in the White House, has read Atul Gawande's story about McAllen, Texas. Mm-hmm. And that is not new information. What's really new is that people didn't know this was the case. The Dartmouth studies have indicated for 30 or 40 years that the way in which healthcare is distributed is not good. And it's not good because there's too much incentive for people to order tests and deliver things that don't work. I think we're going to have to regulate that. At the same time that the nation undertakes a larger share of the burden for care, there's going to be increasing recognition that one very important way to get costs under control is not just to order less, but to create a healthier citizenry. And emphasis on exercise and diet control and vaccination and a lot of other things that clearly represent good public health. There's a reason why well-educated people who have greater means have longer life expectancy. And that's not just about living in houses that have better temperature control. It's about the way in which they care for themselves. And those principles, which are not that difficult to inculcate, we're going to play a greater role, I believe, in what we do. The third element, which I'm a little less sanguine about than Barack Obama may be, is the way in which we increasingly use information technology to both allow doctors to care for patients and patients to people to get health information. I just think this is a much more expensive and difficult enterprise. Having seen it up close at a hospital, has a very advanced system which is not particularly interoperable with other hospitals, costs us well over $100 million a year to operate. So I think that this is not a simple, cheap solution, but I think in the long run, information technology will be very useful in improving healthcare. That won't be part of the healthcare reform package, but a lot of attention is being given by many groups in Washington to how we do this eventually. I just think it's 10, 15 years off.
Well, that, I'm afraid, wraps up our time this evening. I apologize to all the people who wanted to ask questions, and I thank Harold Varmus. Now, Harold's going to be signing the five or six books that you're each going to buy upstairs in the
lobby.
Happy
to answer a question for anybody who buys a book.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.